Welcome to Artrageous, a weekly podcast about the truly outrageous stories in the art and design world. Hello, everyone. Carrie here with another installment in the Artrageous saga of super exciting and incredibly weird story topics. After the fun I had with last week's episode, I kind of wanted to continue with the super weird and goofy stuff this week. So I dug up my research notes for an episode topic that I had contemplated doing quite a while ago. I'm talking all the way back in January, according to this Google Docs history. I think at the time I opted to do something else, like the Banksy story, because that's a more well-known topic. And as I was getting this podcast up and running, I kind of wanted to start with some big stories right out of the gate. And while this one is kind of well known, it's clearly not nearly as big as the Banksy mystery. On top of that, because it centers around a legal case, I was able to access some official court documents, and to be honest, that kind of got overwhelming really quickly. So I shelved the topic for a while, but now that I'm finally ahead of schedule at the moment with my research, I figured it would be fun to pick this one back up and finally bring it to the table for this week's episode. Some backstory about me and why I found this case so interesting is that when I originally chose my college, I started out as a photography major. I had learned photography in high school using 35mm black and white film, and I fell in love with the process. Anything from exploring when taking photos to developing the film and then going back into the darkroom and seeing the pictures just come to life right before my eyes, I just absolutely loved it. I even got a job at JCPenney as a photographer in their portrait studio, which admittedly was the shortest job I ever had because photographing children was an absolutely miserable experience with the way that their process worked. Really, what I got super into was nature photography. I think when I graduated high school, my dream job at the time was to do either nature photography for National Geographic or even do concert photography for alternative press because I love rock music. Well, when I got into college at the end of my first year, I just wasn't seeing those career paths panning out, especially since I did not want to be photographing weddings and children for the rest of my life. Pets, maybe. People and kids, that was an absolute hard no. So shout out and kudos to everyone who does that for a living or even as a hobby, because that whole thing is no joke and y'all are saints for doing it. But yeah, I scrapped the photo major idea and chose illustration instead, but I did take extra courses like studio lighting and digital imaging so that I could still get my photography minor. To this day, I still adore animal and nature photography, and it actually makes up a big majority of the accounts that I follow on Instagram. But long story short, that's probably a little bit more background about me than you probably cared to hear, but it's what brought me to today's topic and how we got here in the first place. So after all of that, what is today's topic? Well, today we are talking about a wildlife conservation photographer named David Slater, who found himself in a huge legal battle over his own photo because of crazy animal rights activists. Before we get into the specifics of what happened, I did want to give a bit of background on David Slater. While this story is super fun, there is a real person behind all of this craziness that we're going to talk about today, so I just wanted to make sure that I cover all the bases and give a good picture of what's going on, if you will. David Slater is a photographer from Lancashire, England, who got his start with a camera at the age of 14. As he writes on his website, he started out by taking photographs of the countryside, which developed his deep passion for the natural environment and wildlife. In college, he earned a PhD in earth sciences and then spent 5 years of postdoctoral research in volcanic eruption prediction. But even all that work and all that time investing into that PhD, that couldn't keep him from his true passion of adventure and wildlife photography. He loves the rainforest, and he's gone on multiple trips that have been photo commissions for conservation groups. When not on commission, he spends time all over the world, including Africa and, of course, the UK, where he was born. His accolades include tons of photography awards and even more features in highly established wildlife magazines, television and news shows, radio shows, and now we can even add a mention in the Artrageous podcast to his resume. I think I'll have to contact him about getting Artrageous added to his website's list. But yeah, that's a very high-level background of David Slater. looking at his website, all of the different research articles I found, and all of the interviews I've seen where he talks about his work and today's episode topic, he seems like a really great guy that honestly could have been great friends with Steve Irwin back in the day. Okay, so David Slater has gone on a bunch of conservation trips to take photos on commission, and I think it's safe to say that he did some adventuring himself too. On one of these trips, he had an amazing opportunity to travel to Indonesia to take photographs of a critically endangered species of primates. On the scale of least concern to extinct species, the crested black macaque is considered critically endangered, which is only two steps away from extinction. So I'd say that this was a pretty awesome gig for David. David traveled to a national park in Indonesia where you have to have permission to enter. So in an effort to capture some good photos for the conservation story he was working on, he decided to arrange a three-day trip into the park where he could shadow a group of black-crested macaques, basically just following them around and seeing what photos he could get. On the first day, he captured what he called standard snapshots of the monkeys. Think of those kinds of photos of monkeys that are mostly like full body from some kind of distance away, and that's basically the shots that he was getting. The next morning, he got up super early at around dawn and found the group of monkeys again and just started following them around. It was almost midday on that second day when the group of about 25 monkeys stopped for a rest and a grooming session. If you've ever lugged around a ton of photo equipment or even any kind of supplies, you know how heavy that stuff can get. So I'm sure David was super glad for the break. And that's when something kind of cool happened. As he was sitting there with his camera, kind of close to him, but not close enough to be overtly threatening, some of the monkeys began to notice him and come just a little bit closer. When he held out his hand, one of the monkeys reached out and held it. As if that wasn't enough of a once-in-a-lifetime experience, after about 15 minutes, the monkey started picking through his hair while he was sitting on the ground, almost like he was forming a friendship with them, if you will. And of course, he wanted a photo of what was happening. So he was super careful in setting up his camera on a log and trying to use the self-timer function to capture him holding hands with the monkeys. Even though he was kind of nervous that the monkeys would get scared and run away, if you've ever taken a photo of an animal, and I'm thinking especially very smart and inquisitive wild animals like these monkeys, as soon as they heard the sound of the shutter, they started showing a lot of interest in his camera. One of the monkeys actually picked up the camera and tried to run away with it. How panicking would that be to see a monkey running off with your super expensive photo equipment? I couldn't imagine. And think about some of the big chunky lenses photographers use. This probably wasn't a tiny little camera like the size of a cell phone. This was a whole DSLR camera and lens setup. As David describes it in the interview I was watching, he was almost wrestling with this monkey to get his camera back. In the process, the shutter was firing and the monkey got even more intrigued. It sounds like it was just an absolute mess trying to get this camera back. Like with me and my bad monkey puns, David is able to laugh about it now when he looks back on it. And luckily, his guide was able to help him get his camera back. So crisis averted. Unfortunately, the photos that he got back from that debacle were all crazy blurry and complete rubbish, as he says. So he deleted them, but he got this idea that he wanted a full-face portrait of the monkeys with one looking straight down the lens. He didn't have one of those yet because, like I mentioned, he really only had long-distance shots from day one of his trip. So he was really hoping to get that money monkey shot. After setting his camera up on a tripod and basically monkey-proofing it so that they couldn't steal it again, he moved away from the setup and slowly the monkeys took interest in that camera again. He's not sure if it was their reflection in the lens that caught their attention or if they could see the shutter release, but these monkeys were so into this camera. And that's how he was able to capture the photos that we know so well today. On July 4th, 2011, several publications picked up the story and published the photos. Naturally, as media channels tend to do, they shortened this story to basically, monkey steals camera and snaps a photo of himself, which isn't totally true. There's the part of the story where the monkeys did steal his camera and he was wrestling with them to try to get it back, but he didn't get any usable photos from that. And then there's the part of the story where he was much more intentional with the setup of things, where he had set up the remote cable release and wide-angle lens, and had also optimized camera settings like predictive autofocus. And then he stepped back to encourage the monkeys to interact with the camera to take the photos that were published. That's a lot more in-depth than having a monkey steal your camera and magically take a perfect selfie. Regardless, David Slater never expected the attention that these photos got. He was inundated with requests for interviews and TV appearances across the world, and he received so much press for these photos. I truly don't think it was ever his intention to get famous when he shared these photos. When his agent first persuaded him to publish the photos, they really only expected it to get into maybe 3 or 4 papers throughout the UK. And on top of that, reading his blog post about it, he says he never appeared on any TV shows because he doesn't want the story to be about him and his experience. He wants it to be about the monkeys and the conservation effort. So yeah, I really don't think he ever thought that these photos would be so widely recognized as they are, and he for sure did not expect what came next. When we come back from the break, we'll get into the rest of this story that is just bananas. Welcome back, everyone. Before that quick break, we talked about how wildlife photographer David Slater had a once-in-a-lifetime experience in the Indonesian jungle with a group of monkeys, and how he came away with some photos that really piqued the interest of the media. These photos were appearing everywhere, including Wikimedia Commons. In July 9th, 2011, just 5 days after David had licensed the photos to a few magazines, Wikimedia Commons uploaded the monkey selfie photos from the Daily Mail article. Now, this is a big problem for David. If you don't know, Wikimedia Commons is a media repository for free-to-use images, sounds, videos, just a whole bunch of media types. Items in this database are made available to everyone under a free content license within the public domain, meaning that anyone can use them without crediting or licensing them from the original photographer. David Slater realized this a few days later, and of course he sent a request to the Wikimedia Foundation to have the photos removed from their database. After all, they were his photos that he held intellectual copyright over. At first, someone at the company with at least half a brain decided to remove the photos because, no, these photos are not public domain images. But that decision was quickly reversed, and the photos were re-added to the database after a community discussion regarding their copyright nature. According to the foundation, the reasoning was that copyright cannot vest in non-human authors, and when a work's copyright cannot vest in a human, it falls into the public domain. Effectively, they determined that because David was not the person who pressed that shutter release button to take the photos, and that because the monkeys that actually took the photos aren't human, the photo is not copyrighted and is a public domain image. And if fighting one battle wasn't annoying enough, David Slater then had to fight more. Other sites like TechDirt then posted the photos with the same public domain license and argued that the photographs were in the public domain because the monkey was not a legal person capable of holding a copyright, and Slater could not hold the copyright of the photo because he was not involved in its creation. Wait a minute. Not involved in the creation? First of all, David Slater had literally spent 3 days in a treacherous jungle to try to get these photos. So yes, I would say he was involved. And in the case that this statement has an issue with phrasing, I will also note that David did a lot of work in setting up the camera for the photo. Not only did he have the creative vision to come up with this idea, but he was also the one optimizing all the camera settings and setting up the whole scenario. So I wholeheartedly believe and know with like 99% certainty that a monkey alone could not have taken that photo on its own. Keep in mind, these sites were thinking that the story behind the photo was just a monkey stole a camera and took a photo. And that makes sense that they would think that because that's what the media wrote. Surely everything the media reports is 100% correct without error or misleading statements, right? Well, naturally, David Slater continued to try to get these images removed from these sites and to try to claim the copyright to his own work. But he kept running into the issue of copyright law and what is or is not permissible within the boundaries of the law as it was written. There were opinions on this from both sides. You have the people like me who say, okay, he might not have pulled the trigger, but he was the only other human involved in what it took to get this photo, and it was some extensive involvement. Heck, it was even his own camera. So I'm sitting here in camp grant the copyright, but there are other people who say, well, only works created by a human can be granted copyright under United States copyright law, which would exclude an artwork created by an animal without human intervention. The U.S. Copyright Office will not register works produced by animals, so since this monkey pressed the shutter release, the monkey was the creator, and since the creator is an animal, the work can't be copyrighted, regardless of who owns the equipment that created the photo. And yes, I know that's U.S. copyright law and not U.K. copyright law, which is also important because the U.K. is where David Slater lives. This was a worldwide debate that was so widely talked about that it resulted in the U.S. Copyright Office publishing their opinion on the matter on August 21st, 2014. The U.S. Copyright Office decided that the picture was not susceptible to copyright protection because of what boils down to the monkey pressed the shutter release button to take the photo. They further clarified their stance to not grant the copyright protection to the photo, stating that it would be equal to the assignment of copyright protection to a mural painted by an elephant. And yes, that example is legit listed under a photograph taken by a monkey in Chapter 300, Section 313.2 of the Copyrightable Authorship PDF on the U.S. Copyright Office's official government website. So that was a huge bummer. But then again, this wasn't necessarily law yet. It was just an opinion. So I do want to make that clear. Anyway, the very next day, on August 22nd, 2014, the UK Intellectual Property Office said, while animals cannot own copyright under the UK law, the question as to whether the photographer owns copyright is more complex. It depends on whether the photographer has made a creative contribution to the work, and this is a decision which must be made by the courts. Boom. There you have it. Since he set up the scenario for the shot to be taken, optimized the camera settings, set up the flash, and did other stuff, and he did all of this in a very intentional way to execute a creative vision, then I would say yes, David Slater should be granted the copyright under UK law. So a loss in one country and a win in another. Not the best outcome for David Slater, but at least that's the end of this episode, right? Huh. No, no, no. That is way too simple and boring for this podcast. Of course there's a twist. As if all of these previous events weren't enough, the photos also caught the attention of one of the most infamous animal rights activist groups of all time. In December of 2014, David Slater published a book called Wildlife Personalities that featured the monkey selfie photos. Well, I guess someone at PETA decided they were bored and didn't have enough puppies to save, so the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals filed a lawsuit against Slater and his publishing company on behalf of the monkey, who they arbitrarily named Naruto because David Slater was infringing upon Naruto's copyright. Are you kidding me? First, they named an Indonesian monkey after a Japanese anime character, but then they took it upon themselves to file a lawsuit on his behalf. If you look it up, the legal court case's name is actually Naruto v. Slater. So yep, they definitely did that. And I won't even get into the whole legal jurisdiction issue with David Slater being based in the UK, but the lawsuit being filed in the US. That's just something else ridiculous to add onto this list of crazy. Other than just being a notoriously miserable organization to be pitted against, why would PETA do something as crazy as this? Looking at their website, I was actually able to find an article from 2017 that says, Naruto intentionally and purposefully acted to create his selfie, and he should own it, just as any human being unquestionably owns the selfie that he or she takes. And later in this article it reads, PETA seeks the court's permission to manage the copyright in the photos, license them for commercial use, and use 100% of the proceeds to benefit Naruto and his community. Breaking this down even further, if my understanding of the premise of the lawsuit is correct, PETA truly thought that Naruto the monkey was the copyright owner of the photo because it was the monkey that pressed the shutter release button. Didn't we already establish that animals cannot hold copyright under U.S. law? Is it just me, or does every part of this sound insane? I'm just at a total loss for words, and I honestly feel like I lost half of my brain cells reading through PETA's statement. I will admit that PETA does some good work on behalf of animals, and I myself am a big proponent of animal conservation and well-being. But really? I wondered how it was even legal for them to bring up this lawsuit, so I looked into it, but apparently there's a thing called the next friend principle in copyright law, where someone can sue in the name of someone else who is unable to do so. A logical example would be someone who passed away, but I guess in this case, it's a creature who literally can't even speak and has no clue what a photo even is. Just straight insanity. Okay, so PETA filed this lawsuit in September 2015, and you know how slow the legal system is. 4 months later, in January 2016, a U.S. district judge said that the U.S. copyright law does not extend its protection to animals, and he dismissed the case. Honestly, the case was so ridiculous that I probably would have done the same because it just seems like a huge waste of taxpayer money to deal with that nonsense. And that should have been the end of that. But really, the biggest bummer was that because the U.S. Copyright Office had already published their opinion that Slater didn't own the copyright, now that this case was thrown out, that meant that there was legally no copyright license on the photographs at all and that the pictures would remain in the public domain. So even though the judge threw this case and in theory got PETA off of David Slater's back, David Slater still could not get these images off of the public domain sites like Wikimedia Commons. But if we know anything about PETA, they do not sit down and shut up easily. Even with David Slater still not being granted the copyright, this wasn't good enough for PETA, and they still wanted to manage the copyright of the photos. On March 20th, 2016, PETA appealed the case to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and allowed for another round of pun-filled media headlines. We've talked about appeals courts a couple of times on Artrageous, and this is another one of those cases that just won't go away. After that appeal was filed in March 2016, it took another 4 months for the court to hear the oral arguments for both sides. I know the U.S. Supreme Court records their oral arguments and posts them on the government website, and I've brought clips of one of those recordings onto the show before in the Andy Warhol copyright episode, but I'm not sure that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals does the same. Or at least I wasn't able to find any recordings from this case, which is a huge bummer because I honestly would have loved to hear some of the ridiculous arguments that were made on behalf of this monkey. But without those clips, I guess you'll just have to take it from me that I wasn't the only one who thought this whole case was absolutely ridiculous. Even David Slater, who's caught in the middle of all of this, wrote in a response on Facebook, "Photographers are under enough pressure these days to make a living. We don't need ridiculous interpretations of what copyright is from ignorant people like PETA and Wikipedia." Yes, I couldn't have said it better myself in such few words. On his own Facebook page, he wrote that his goal and PETA's goals are, quote, "far more important than battles over copyright between me and a monkey I want to help." And I think that's a really good point. I just find it so ironic that David Slater is an animal activist and conservationist, and yet he was sued by an activist group. It makes zero sense because they are literally on the same side. It would be different if Slater was some horrible person who invaded the monkey sanctuary and forced them into taking this photo somehow and harmed them in the process and then made a whole bunch of money off of it. But that is absolutely not the case. David Slater cares deeply for animals and has devoted his entire career to wildlife conservation. So it's just absolutely insane that PETA would choose to pick this fight that is so petty and small when looking at the bigger picture. Then again, let's be real, no one has ever accused PETA of being the most rational organization. Well, apparently someone finally came to their senses, and on August 4th, 2017, both sides asked the judge to dismiss the case because they were close to coming to an out-of-court settlement. The agreement that they finally came to was that David Slater would donate 25% of all future profits from the photos to charities dedicated to protecting the critically endangered crested black macaques. What's interesting is that despite David Slater and PETA being able to hug it out and give a joint statement about their shared goal for animal rights, the U.S. courts decided not to toss the lawsuit. They actually denied Slater's and PETA's motion to dismiss the case. While this might sound crazy, it's not unprecedented, and it is within the court's right to do so. From what I've gathered, it mostly happens when the court decides that a legal battle should proceed in order to resolve issues that maybe will pop up again in the future. So instead of providing a ruling to settle the specific dispute between the two parties, the goal then becomes to set a legal precedent for similar future cases. So the court was basically saying that it's in the best interest of the U.S. legal system to have this case come to a verdict. That verdict and legal precedent is now established. Humans can file copyright lawsuits, not animals. Sorry, PETA, no more filing copyright lawsuits on behalf of animals. Not only did the court basically rule in favor, even though I don't think they actually granted him that copyright, they at least also took the opportunity to slam PETA in the process for its actions and accuse the organization of using Naruto as a pawn while pretending to be a quote-unquote friend. The quote from the ruling reads, "PETA appears to have failed to live up to the title of friend. In the wake of PETA's proposed dismissal, Naruto is left without an advocate, his supposed friend having abandoned Naruto's substantive claims in what appears to be an effort to prevent the publication of a decision adverse to PETA's institutional interests. Were he capable of recognizing this abandonment, we wonder whether Naruto might initiate an action for breach of confidential relationship against his former next friend, PETA, for its failure to pursue his interests before its own. Puzzlingly, while representing to the world that animals are not ours to eat, wear, experiment on, use for entertainment, or abuse in any other way, PETA seems to employ Naruto as an unwitting pawn in its ideological goals. I would like to initiate a slow clap, or a round of ape applause, if you will, on behalf of the judge in this case for saying what needed to be said, even though there was some elevated legalese language in there that I kind of could have done without. But what about David Slater? Where did he end up in all of this? Well, I don't think there were any champagne celebrations after the settlement and court ruling, and as fun as the photos are, they kind of more or less ruined Slater's life. After all is said and done, and after being dragged through the courts for more than 5 years, David Slater is basically broke. And even before the legal stuff, he lost out on a huge amount of revenue on the photo as a result of it being published to Wikimedia Commons as a public domain image. Although he's never commented on the full amount the photo made him, he did comment to Business Insider in July 2017 that he made £2,000 for the picture the first year after it was taken. After it was released on Wikimedia Commons, all interest in buying and licensing just went out the window. He estimates he's lost at least £10,000 or more in income, and it is killing his business. Add in the financial drain from legal fees, and it's to the point that he couldn't even afford a plane ticket to fly to the U.S. for the court proceedings, let alone buy new camera equipment. I didn't mention it earlier, but now that I'm talking about David Slater specifically with the outcomes of this case, I was watching a really intriguing interview I found from about 8 years ago, where David was being interviewed by a man named Tom Miggott, who is also a UK photographer. In this interview, around the 18-minute mark, David was talking about how the US Copyright Office treated the photo and the photographer. He comments on how, okay, the US Copyright Office published this opinion on the topic that a photo taken by a monkey is not copyrightable. But David makes an intriguing point that by issuing that opinion, it's almost insulting to photographers because with the way that opinion is written, they are insinuating that the creation and creative aspect of a photograph is simply just pressing a button. There's no consideration for any of what it takes to get that photograph. So where is that consideration for the amount of creative contribution that the photographer placed in setting up the image? Or does it simply boil down to the assertion that David isn't the photographer in this case because he wasn't the one pressing the button? Really, it's all just pretty ludicrous. But if you are interested in the interview I'm talking about, I've linked it in the show notes in case you want to hear the story from David Slater himself and get some firsthand information from David on what it was like to be in this whole crazy situation and some of his opinions and takeaways on the topic. And of course, I want to say thank you to Tom Meggett for facilitating that interview and hosting it on his blog. As a totally unsolicited plug for Tom, I will say that his blog has some really interesting stuff in it. So feel free to take a look at more of the content he has after you're done watching that interview video. So there you have it, everyone. That is the story of the monkey selfie court case, legally known as Naruto v. Slater. Overall, I'd say it was just a bunch of monkey business, especially on PETA's part. And I'd give you my closing opinions on the matter, but I think I might have inadvertently made them pretty clear throughout this episode. Instead, I would love to hear what you think. So feel free to leave a written review in your podcast app, or just leave me a 5-star review if you have 2 seconds to do that for me. Speaking of the podcast, I heard it through the Ape Vine that there's another episode of Artrageous coming your way next week. And while I do apologize for the subtle or not so subtle monkey puns throughout this episode, I cannot guarantee that any future Artrageous episodes will be safe from my attempts at being punny. But yeah, next week I will be back with another episode, and I'm kind of leaning towards some more true crime stuff. So keep an eye out for that next Thursday. And until then, stay Artrageous.
Series music created by Arensen. Music and transition sounds licensed from Motion Array. Artrageous is a proud partner of Stoveleg Media.
Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.